is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington, and here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The people I'm representing don't want to stay in South Africa anymore. Before you ask me if my people will stay in South Africa, did you ask your people if they accept us now, if they're willing to accept us like family now?
That was Lawrence Nantumba Aaron Motsoa Lidi on a new effort by the UN Refugee Agency to reduce a decade-long backlog in the asylum seeker system. Details coming up also. A town in Mozambique was attacked by terrorists from three directions. And thousands of Cameroonians are stranded after heavy rains collapsed the only road to the country's troubled northwest region. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Nearly 150 people have been killed in a series of attacks in southwestern Niger in the past week. Gunmen on motorbikes killed 137 people during coordinated raids on villages on Sunday. Reuters reports another 10 were killed in raids Wednesday. What's behind this latest violence and what's needed to bring it under control? To find out, VOA's Jason Patinkin reached out to Nadia Adam in Bamako, Mali. Adam is a Sahel expert and a researcher with the South Africa-based Institute for Security Studies.
Well, these regions are already vulnerable as they share borders with Mali and Burkina Faso, who have already been experiencing targeted attacks against civilians for some time now. One of the reasons we can put forward could be the groups sometimes find themselves in a logic of competition and rivalry. And in Niger, two groups operate mainly in the Tillaberi region, the Jnim, the group of support to Islam and Muslims, as well as the Islamic State in the West Africa province. And these attacks could be a sort of message to mark territory. Another way to explain these attacks could be the fact that when you look at the attack in Tilia, it indicates that cattle were also stolen. And previous research from ISS notes that groups often resort to this strategy to finance their operations. And Niger was also going through a post-election crisis. Everyone was focused on the political situation of the country, and groups, as we've seen, are very opportunistic, and they probably saw all this attention diverted from them as an opportunity to conduct more operations.
You mentioned two different groups. Is it clear which group was responsible for the most recent attacks?
The attacks have not been claimed by any of the groups, but when we look at the way these attacks were carried, we could think that they were likely perpetrated by the Islamic State-aligned militant group that operates in the country.
And you mentioned they might be trying to mark territory. How do the people living there view these groups? Do they have support from locals, or are they controlling or marking this territory more through force or through fear?
It could be either by threat and fear, by imposing fear on local populations, or by, let's say, aligning with them and showing them that they're here to support and protect them. In this particular case in Niger, if we look at the attack in Tilia, the civilians that were targeted were actually refugees and internally displaced people. If they moved from one place to another, it was probably to get away from this cycle of violence.
Zooming out a bit, there's the national politics that you mentioned, but there's also international issues. Both the U.S. and French militaries are operating in the Sahel, but it seems like the violence continues and even gets worse. Can you comment on that?
There's been a focus on military-driven responses for the past few years, and these responses generally overlook the links between security, governance, and development. All three dimensions must be dealt with. Just dealing with the military side of this crisis is not going to help resolve it. In Niger, this phenomenon of attacks on civilians is rather new, and it could be an opportunity for the new president, Bazoum, to draw lessons from neighboring Burkina and Mali, who have been experiencing these attacks for some time now. And this is the perfect time for new leaders to rethink their country's strategies. They must learn from recent experiences, and it applies both to countries and their international partners, such as the U.S. and France.
That was Nadia Adam, a Sahel expert and a researcher with the South Africa-based Institute for Security Studies, speaking with VOA's Jason Patinkin. South Africa's government says it will cut the severity of the country's electricity crisis by leaning on private firms to provide supplemental clean power. Years of alleged mismanagement and corruption at state power company Eskom have resulted in regular blackouts across the country for more than a decade. It calls these power breakdowns load shedding, cutting electricity to large parts of South Africa when stations cannot keep up with demand. Darren Taylor reports.
Energy Minister Gwede Mantashe says the additional electricity will come from a range of sources, including solar, wind, and natural gas, but it'll only be available late next year. Mantashe says that private energy producers are investing 45 billion rands in the projects. In the meantime, he adds, Eskom will improve its infrastructure to try to end the blackouts. But that's not going to happen anytime soon, says energy analyst and former Eskom manager Ted Blom, who's adamant South Africa remains on course for disaster.
Eskom's current CEO talks about up to 70 days, 64 to 70 days of load shedding this winter, which is in a couple of weeks' time, and this summer, which is a little bit further away. That's a cost of crashing businesses, GDP in South Africa, of over 350 billion rand.
Blom called for independent power firms to generate electricity back in 2008, when the outages began. He says the government's sudden desire to now use private energy companies leaves him wondering.
What we're seeing now is unfortunately very suspect, because the renewable parts of it don't address the peak demands of our economy, come at an immense cost. I mean, the big window one.
He says a few people are going to get very rich by selling expensive power to the state, which will then pass the cost on to consumers. And given all the corruption in South Africa in the past few decades, the deals are deeply concerning. South African Federation of Trade Unions chief Zwelin Zima Vavi says his organization could not be more opposed to privatization of any part of the electricity supply.
We regard energy just like oxygen, water, education, healthcare, all of those baskets of the most fundamental areas of human life, to be issues that should be provided by the state itself, mainly because...
What's at play here, says Vavi, is not a caring strategy by the government to end South Africa's electricity woes.
We see all of these announcements from the minister, now by the president, to be a consistent step of taking energy away from the hands of the public and handing it over to the hands of the private sector to maximize profit.
While Blom supports privatization of parts of the energy grid, like Vavi, he's extremely suspicious of the money involved. He also doesn't trust Eskom's motives in agreeing to pay a much higher price for coal from Australian mining company South 32. Eskom says not paying the higher price, which hasn't been made public, could plunge the country into an even worse energy crisis. Blom says he's been given insight into the numbers involved, and they're massively inflated.
I feel so strongly about this, about the lack of transparency, the opaqueness, the lack of an open tender, etc., that I commit myself that within the next 7 days, I will personally lay a charge against the incumbents of that transaction at the Sandton Police Station under the Prevention of Corruption Act. I am so furious about the ongoing corruption at Eskom that I will...
Eskom denies any corruption, and the government says all its business with independent power producers will be clean, just like the energy it expects them to supply. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
South Africa and the UN High Commission for Refugees have signed a groundbreaking agreement to end the country's decade-long backlog in the asylum seeker system, which stands at well over 100,000. Under the agreement, the UNHCR will provide funds and technical support to the Refugee Appeal Authority of South Africa. The target is to eliminate the backlog in the next 4 years. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
UNHCR will provide $9.6 million in technical support to the Refugee Appeal Authority of South Africa, which adjudicates rejected applications for asylum seekers and refugees. UNHCR also will pay for 36 new members of the appeals authority, including training and equipment. Aaron Mutswaledi is the Minister of Home Affairs.
This is to deal with a backlog on asylum seeker appeal. In other words, we are talking of people who have gone through the asylum system and has not been accepted.
Over the past decade or so, the backlog in the asylum system has grown to over 153,000. This has been caused largely by the congestion of the asylum system by political and economic migrants from Africa and beyond who are desperate to get permits to live and work in South Africa. As a result, most of the asylum applicants have been rejected, especially those from economic migrants. The applicants have, however, brought them back on the appeal, resulting in the huge backlog. In 2008, the Department of Home Affairs received 207,206 asylum applications, compared with only 11,135 in 1998. The Home Affairs Department says its system was designed to handle only 53,000 applications per year. However, not all refugees are excited by this kind of assistance from the UNHCR. Refugee Lawrence Natumba is part of a group that has protested for over a year, demanding to be relocated to another country. This group accuses South Africa of failing to protect refugees and asylum seekers following a string of xenophobic violence that has left dozens dead and thousands displaced.
The people I'm representing don't want to stay in South Africa anymore. Before you ask me if my people will stay in South Africa, did you ask your people if they accept us now, if they're willing to get to accept us like family now?
Lorraine Landau is the chairperson of the South African Human Rights Research in Human Mobility and the Politics of Difference at the South African Center for Migration and Society at the Witwatersrand University in Johannesburg.
I think what we've seen is that migrants of all kinds, whether they're asylum seekers or not, are often frustrated in their effort to become part of South African society or to make a life here. The delays from Home Affairs in processing paperwork obviously is a big part of this, and it's a positive move to see that South Africa is trying to address this backlog.
Since the 2008 global financial crisis, South Africa has seen an influx of both political and economic refugees, with the majority preferring to take the asylum seeker route in order to get legal documents enabling them to work and live in South Africa. There are estimated to be 185,000 asylum seekers in South Africa. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Thousands of Cameroonians are stranded after heavy rains Thursday collapsed the only road to the country's troubled northwest region. As Moki Edwin Kindeka reports from Yaoundé, Those left stranded include healthcare workers with coronavirus tests and treatments.
Cameroon authorities say thousands of people Thursday night flooded into Babadju, a village on the outskirts of the northwest region, after the only road to the region collapsed from heavy rains. Among them is 36-year-old nurse Doris Tendong with Cameroon's Minister of Health. She was traveling to the English-speaking town of Bamenda, she says, with test kits and treatment for COVID-19. Cameroon's Minister of Health expects her to join other health workers in Bamenda, says Tendong, to educate on the increasing numbers of COVID-19 cases. She says within just 1 week, more than 20 people died of COVID-19, and the number of health workers testing positive is increasing due to negligence and lack of knowledge. Tendong, who was dispatched from Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé, is among thousands waiting for authorities to repair the road. Officials said the damage has so far stopped at least 200 vehicles from getting into or out of Bamenda, the region's capital. The stranded travelers also included traders and aid workers helping people suffering from the region's separatist conflict. Cameroon's Public Works Minister, Emmanuel Nganou Djoumissi, says engineers have been sent to build an emergency road to rescue those stranded. He said measures would also be taken to prevent further damage to the run-down road.
Je demande que quand il pleut, que les véhicules s'arrêtent.
Djoumissi says he has ordered signposts erected that will prohibit vehicles up to 2 hours after there is rainfall, and any cheats will be severely punished. He says Cameroonians should rest assured that peace is returning to the English-speaking western regions and the entire road will be constructed very soon. Efforts to repair the road in 2018 were abandoned after armed men attacked workers and torched construction equipment. Work resumed in 2020, but armed men again attacked, abducting some workers who were only freed after ransom was paid. Cameroon authorities blamed Anglophone rebels fighting to create a breakaway state from the French-speaking majority. Separatists did not confirm or deny the attacks on construction workers, but have claimed responsibility for previous attacks on buses along the road. Authorities said the engineers sent to build an emergency road to rescue the stranded would be protected by Cameroon's military. Bamenda lawmaker Nestus Frumanju says the road is important because it links to West Africa and the Economic Community of Central African States, CEMAC.
The road, it's of capital economic importance. Bamenda acts as a linkage between West Africa and Central Africa because from Bamenda, you have access to all of the Republic of Cameroon, which in turn have access to Chad, Gabon, Equatorial Guinea, or Central Africa. People who live from Nigeria can freely circulate into the CEMAC zone and do business.
A 443-kilometer extension of the road linking Bamenda to the Nigerian town of Enugu was completed in 2020. It is part of the Trans-African Highway, conceived more than 30 years ago as a transcontinental link from Lagos, Nigeria, on the Atlantic Ocean to Mombasa, Kenya, on the Indian Ocean. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta issued new restrictions today to combat a third wave of COVID-19 infections that has quickly hit record levels and filled hospitals. Effective at midnight, Kenyatta restricted travel in the capital, Nairobi, and 4 other countries and ordered all his cabinet ministers and executive officers to get vaccinated after an initially slow uptake among the public. They got their jabs on live TV after Kenyatta's address. The president also imposed a stricter curfew and ordered bars closed. In-person schooling was suspended, apart from students taking exams. Kenyatta said the positive test rate of COVID hit 22% this week, compared with January's 2%. You're listening to African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suwuhib in Washington. Here is a recap of our top stories. Nearly 150 people have been killed in a series of attacks in southwestern Niger in the past week. And South Africa and the UN High Commission for Refugees have signed a groundbreaking agreement to end the country's decade-long backlog in the asylum seeker system. Thanks for listening to VOA Africa. And for more news and information, visit our website at voanews.com. Egypt's Suez Canal Authority is trying to refloat a giant container ship blocking traffic in a main artery of the key waterway for a third straight day and disrupting world trade. Dredgers tried to clear a channel for hundreds of trapped ships carrying billions of dollars in cargo. Terrorists attacked the town of Palma in Mozambique's Cabo Delgado province from three directions, according to a defense ministry official. The Associated Press reports the coordinated attacks began just hours after Total, the France-based oil and gas company, announced it would resume construction of its $20 billion offshore gas project a few kilometers outside the town of Palma. Defense Ministry spokesman Colonel Omar Saranga told reporters that defense forces are tirelessly working to re-establish security and order as fast as possible. He said he did not yet have information on casualties or damage in the attack. News reports say about 100 extremists attacked the airport and two other locations. Botswana has repatriated 242 refugees who fled Zimbabwe at the height of a deadly violence in the build-up to the 2008 presidential election. However, some 15 families have refused to register for voluntary repatriation, citing fear of persecution if they return. From Habrone, Botswana, reporter Mokandisi Dube has the details.
The refugees were transported to the Zimbabwe border in groups this week. Some, like Wasu Chibi, say they don't want to return home but registered for repatriation due to fear of deportation. Chibi, a supporter of the opposition movement for democratic change, MDC, says their homes were burned and they face persecution.
We have got activists who ran away from death, whose houses were burned. We have people who were raped. Some of them are crippled as we speak. We have got only God to look up to. Maybe, God willing, we will survive the torture of ZANU-PF. Maybe, God willing, we will survive and come back to Botswana as border jumpers.
Chibi says refugees were not allowed to look for jobs in Botswana, so they will return home empty-handed.
Since 2010, refugees were encamped in the camp, Dufu refugee camp. They're not allowed to work, so there are no resources at all.
Some refugees expressed concern that they return home when there are few available job opportunities amid the COVID-19 restrictions. Kate Pond, spokesperson for the UN High Commission on Refugees, UNHCR, says refugees were given $520, food parcels and tents for those who lost their homes. She says refugees who have not registered for voluntary repatriation will be subjected to immigration measures like any foreign national. The Dukwi refugee camp manager Moses Mochabo says the 15 families who did not register to return home cited fears of persecution. Students at tertiary institutions have been allowed to complete their studies. For VOA, this is Mkondisi Dube in Habaroni, Botswana.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suwuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, Thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.